was that the time when you crossed that 50 odd mark and suddenly went to hundreds, the time when you actually introspected ki hamara culture hai kya, like what's our culture, or had you guys decoded it earlier on?
Nahi, wo hundreds pe the first person talked about it. Ultimately, only after we were maybe 1500 did we actually kind of really articulate.
Hello and welcome. I'm Shashank Mehta, founder at The Whole Truth Foods. As the founder of a young startup, I've seen firsthand the immense challenges that come with starting and scaling a company. No founder can be fully prepared for what entrepreneurship looks like. But we can definitely learn from the giants who've come before us. Stalwart founders who've built great companies and who've perhaps faced those very same challenges and overcome them. On this podcast, I speak to them, founder to founder, and try and unearth the whole truth of starting up. Let's begin. Okay. Hey, folks. Please join me in welcoming Sriharsha Majeti, or Harsha, as I assume most people call him. Harsha is the co-founder and the CEO of one of India's biggest and most awesome startups, Swiggy. He's also a dear friend and one of the smartest and, more importantly, one of the most helpful people I've come across in the Indian startup ecosystem. Harsha, such a pleasure having you, and thank you so much for being here.
Hey, thank you, Shashank. It's great to be here. Thanks for thinking of me. Big fan of everything that you do, and it's been a privilege seeing you from the sidelines. Happy to chat today anything about my journey and my experiences.
Awesome. Thank you so much for the kind words. And as you know, today I want to talk to you about, you know, how do you go from thinking like a small company to thinking like a big company? Now, you know, for the first 3 years of your existence, you were not a unicorn. And for the last 3 years, you were. So, like, while I know that, you know, the $1 billion mark is arbitrary, what I'm trying to understand is, in your head as the founder, when do you go from thinking like a small company to thinking like a big company?
Yeah. So I think there's these two concepts. One is the machine, which is the business. And then there's the machine that runs the machine, which is the company, the culture, the ways of working, how you're structured, etc. So soon as, as you go through your journey, there comes a point at which every founder asks themselves, is the machine that's making the machine working well? And in the beginning, you're just a bunch of insurgents, and then you have the 10 or 15 folks that do, and it's just all machine. Just need to go and build what we want to. But some point in that journey, that realization hits you saying, I have to take a step back and think about the machine, the other machine. And that's, I guess, for us, the first moment was when we went from maybe 40, 50 members in the team to, I guess, a few hundred in a matter of 6 months, when we had to go through a crazy scaling journey in 2015. And that's when this starts hitting you, because then there are various folks who've joined in early before the company's whole onboarding and culture, everything is verbalized, and then you start hearing back from people saying, hey, dude, there feels like there are multiple subcultures inside the company, and we need to start figuring out how to tame this in, how to actually articulate to ourselves. And maybe that was the first big moment for me. It's not a lot defined by how large the company is or how much the valuation is, but you just know that, okay, things have escalated quickly. So most of my vantage points are on the inside, actually.
So while I'm going to come back and talk about the culture piece in a bit more depth later on, one question I do want to know is, was that the time when you crossed that 50 odd mark and suddenly went to hundreds, the time when you actually introspected ki hamara culture hai kya, like what's our culture, or had you guys decoded it earlier on?
Nahi, wo hundreds pe the first person talked about it. Ultimately, only after we were maybe 1500 did we actually kind of really articulate and make a deliberate effort. Otherwise, it was still, maybe we were solving for culture, but in a very tribal way, not in a way that you could just rely on the other leaders to act on every time. It was just each had their own view of what is the Swiggy way of working, and some people still thrived and got promoted, some people didn't, and there was a 70%, 60% adherence, let's say, to what we eventually articulate. for the decisions taken post factum. One of the things there, though, Shashank, is you have to keep thinking small to think big at every single stage of the journey. And there's this amazing podcast by Brian Chesky that's available on Spotify where he talks about handcrafted. So that handcrafted nature is just has to be a big part of who you are, no matter what role you do in the organization. Because yes, you are large, but large comes with all things unsexy, which is, you know, scaling and standardization and commoditization so that you can do more of it. But you have to, and we've not done it in every year consistently. It's just something that we're rediscovering, saying we need to go back, think small, think one user, and think about a magical experience that we can create from them, instead of saying scale metrics, move metrics at scale alone. And that is an engine that is important, whether it is to elevate the current experience or to completely do crazy new experiences.
Now, I was saying that's a very interesting one, because it makes me wonder, currently, like, we are very small, so we don't have that dilemma of, you know, if there are 10 options of things to do, I, as a founder, don't need to put on the lens of, will this become a billion? Does this have the potential to become a $1 billion bet or not? But in your case, for the needle to move, it needs to have that potential. So two parts to the question. A, when did you start wearing that hat in resource allocation meetings, where you felt, I will allocate resource only to bets which can become that large that they move the needle? And B, to your point of all big things need to start small, because that's where magic happens. How do you calibrate the two? How do you balance the two?
Actually, there is no balance, because they're on two different paradigms. I think in general, we've never greenlit anything that we thought was going to be small. Either it was going to make a dent, either directly as a business or indirectly through some other means. If neither didn't happen, it's not like we greenlight them anymore. And if we greenlit something, it's because we didn't know better. But if something was deliberately smaller than, you know, biggest dent on our own impact and size, we wouldn't greenlight them. But that's different, right? That is, so we think big when it comes to opportunities. Saying we have to go after large opportunities and solve large problems for the consumer. But to do that, to solve that big problem, you have to think small, and you have to think n is equal to 1 and not get ahead of yourself and say, how can I serve 500,000 users? Because then you suck out the artisanal oxygen out of it on day one. And it's super important on day one to figure out what a beautiful experience for one customer would look like, and then kind of build out along the way. It's not something that we've perfected, but at least have a deep awareness of as an organization, after collecting some scar tissue from some of the things that we did that weren't exactly think small when they started.
But when did you go from a stage where you could do 10 quick, small, low-hanging fruits to get the growth that you needed, to needing to do these one or two really big ones without which the needle wouldn't move? When did that shift happen? Because I assume you can't be doing like 50 small things anymore. There must have come a point where you switched.
No, actually, you'd be surprised. The number of small things increase as the company scales, because even the small things actually have meaningful impact. And in the whole humdrum and prioritization of things, you also realize that the bigger things are much harder to pull off as the organization scales, as there are too many folks in the team that need to be aligned, cross-team collaboration and all of that, which means that every company's roadmap will be a mixture of 2-3 big things, and a bunch of medium things, and a bigger bunch of smaller things. And to that is, I guess, a large company's, should be a large company's roadmap. Not because you're finding it harder to organize internally, because at scale, every small copy changes our economics by 1-2% sometimes. So you have to be on the hunt for newer opportunities. So we don't have an emphasis or an outsized skew on just the big moves. We love big moves. But the more big moves you make, it's harder to pull off also for any organization. So because priorities are harder to establish with everyone. So for example, this year we have a few core goals on food, and then we've said Instamart is a very, very big focus area for us. So we've classified some of these as what we call management team goals, which are the most important. So now you have to go after it no matter what. There may be some big bets of the future, but are seeds today. So you just give them a team and give them a budget and then do some skunk works projects on the side. So actually you do more smaller things as you go.
I want to deep dive into that. These seeds of today, which might take 6, 8, 10 months to germinate.
Or never.
Yeah. Right. How do you ring fence them from the org? How do you incubate the small stuff so that there isn't pressure on that team from day one to start delivering?
Simple things, right? I think there's a lot of over communication that needs to be done. My co-founder Nandan oversees all things new exclusively. I'm very jealous of his job. He makes it a point to over communicate to teams about the need for leaner, smaller teams that can just go quickly, iterate, and not get hung up in large scale decision making, because the impact is going to be in like a very small surface radius. And then figure out how to form like a different engineering contract with the engineering leaders, saying when we are building this, this is the way we'll build it. We'll not build it like a food delivery feature, where you have to think about like 100 check metrics. It's super hard, but we try nevertheless. Another thing is we don't do heavyweight reviews for seeds until it's been a certain amount of time. It's not like the entire management team coming in and chewing on you, saying that where is this, what do you have to show for it. At least give the 2, 3, 4 quarters before you have something to show for. So Nandan keeps talking about this concept, which actually came first from Jeff Bezos, calling the joy of wandering. So the wandering journey is very, very important in 0 to 1. And we just make sure we have that healthy respect for wandering and don't yank the chain for 0 to 1.
One personal experience I have from having worked in Unilever is I don't think big companies have the ability or know how to treat failure, which is an essential component of these seed new bets, right? That by probabilistic nature of things, they will, like, more than half will fail. How do you performance manage and treat the teams which are working on something that didn't go to fruition and fell flat on its face?
Right. So again, that's been a journey for the company, something that I'm kind of fully cognizant of from the last couple of years of experience. I think this whole focus on the inputs is a great thing. However, mastering the art of watering down the whole work of an individual to the inputs is not an easy one as well. Organizations don't have the time. Again, it's all number aaya kya, number nahi aaya kya. And it's very hard. So you have to invest the extra amount of work to make sure that you're going closer and closer to the inputs and not just the outcome. So where not fully on a journey there. I'd say probably 10% done on that. People haven't been penalized per se for failing, at least in the 0 to 1s. Again, failure is on multiple aspects, right? If your operating excellence in core last mile operations is not good, then that's not the same failure as a failure because of the ambiguity and because of the quality of the wandering. So I guess the important thing is to separate from it. I think we've gotten to a stage where there are no penalties for failure. However, I was speaking with Harsh Mariwala recently, a couple of months or 3 months back, and I learned that they have an award called the Intelligent Failure in Marico, where they're celebrating well-executed failures. So that was for me an aha moment, something that I need to do more internally, because I feel we have gravitated into, like, you know, just only celebrating the winners. And to actually celebrate thoughtful risk-taking, you'll have to celebrate the intelligent failures as well. So it's a note for me and my team to do more.
And that's quite tough, right? In the absence of outputs, objectively judging quality of input, because you can't really just judge it by hard work and how much time you saw people spend at it. So any insights and thoughts on that? That's a big open topic, I know, in most big firms. And this Marico example, I didn't know of. I think that's a great one for the Unilevers and P&Gs of the world also to implement. They don't have it. But any insights on that? How do you judge great input in the presence of bad output?
I think as leaders, you'd still know going in how much thought the team put into what the consumer might want, how much effort they did in listening to the consumer, how much agency they showed internally to break barriers that were coming their way. I guess these are all key tenets of being successful in anything new to one. Have that curious mindset, have that relentless mindset, and just show very, very high agency. And the last thing would be the quality of the team that you put together. If it is an Avengers type team and an Avengers type effort, Avengers nahi hua to bhi, I think you can tell. So it's not that hard. You will always be seen by, it's not objective, or it's not like 100% out of 100 out of 100 people in the company can agree with you, but
got it. I want to go back to the scaling piece where you said there's the machine and then there's the machine running the machine.
Right.
How much of your time nowadays do you spend on both of those, like on the machine and on the machine running the machine?
Right. So in my office hours or meeting hours, it would be more like 70% machine and 30% machine running the machine. But in off meeting hours, it would be reverse.
Okay. So I was saying, I want to go back to the culture point that we touched upon earlier, where you said that it was at around 1500 odd folks that you first decoded and started, you know, encoding what your culture is. And by that time, obviously some form of culture would have already taken hold. You had a culture by then.
Yes.
So the exercise at that point of time was, ab ye jo hai, let's decode it and encode it from here onwards so that from 1500 to 10,000 remains the same? Or was it, oh shit, something that we didn't even think of has now become, we need to first change it a bit because this is not what we are going for, and then we will encode it.
What
that journey?
No, that journey, the eventual outcome was 70% of the behaviors that were already being generally maintained throughout the company, which we were really happy for, and the rest 20-30% that were only being displayed in parts of the company that really separated the great from the good. And the core team came together to say, today we have this challenge, and unless we tackle this at scale, we're going to be in trouble. So it was a mix of both, and we were actually quite candid when we opened it up to the entire company also, saying these are the things where I think we're already doing well, must continue. In some places, there was a stop that was explicitly mentioned saying we should stop doing some of this. And there are some places where we said you should start doing some of these. The culture doc is a living organism. And I think one thing we should do, actually, we are refreshing our values as we speak for the first time after we launched it in 2016. Now feel like I should just look at it for every quarter and see how I want to fine tune even sub bullet points or sub copy in a value to just make sure that you're constantly iterating on it. Treating it like a living organism is very important. Are you going to just change it every week? Heck no. But maybe in a 7 years old company, changing it once in 2 years and then waiting for another 4 or 5 years is also too long.
Do you, going back to the the seed bets point, do you consciously create a subculture in teams which are executing 0-1 projects?
Yes.
And that's definitely the thing of the team?
Actually, you know what? The subculture doesn't change the value.
Yeah.
It is just the manifestation of the value. What you think is great is very different in a 0-1 from like a scale entity. So you just over communicate what that 0-1
and maybe the weightages to different values might change. Is it
correct? Of course.
And now that you're such a huge org, how do you, as the founder who early on would have had a complete pulse of the org, how do you keep a finger on the pulse of the org now?
I think even though the org has gotten larger, My radar is still high because I don't encourage anyone also to think about boundaries in the context of an organization. Founder mentality means that there is nothing that's not your job. And when I'm curious and when there's a specific anecdote, then I just go dive deep, make a few calls to a team member, no matter how junior they are and which part of the system they are in to just understand it better. And so organically, because of that curious, paranoid side of me, for me, I've just ended up building pipes across the organization. And those pipes are initiated because of some work, but then we meet in the settings, and if more people, you know, realize that I'm, approachable, then generally, like, a lot of conversations trickle organically. So I think a lot of it still leans on tribal systems. Of course, we're now using software, sentiment analysis, surveys, and all of that as well. But I guess they both are important. The data and the anecdotes are both important. I still run more than I probably should acknowledge on anecdotes.
I guess I'm hazarding a guess here that surveys, etc., are actually the anecdotes are good to form hypotheses, and the surveys are good to then confirm or deny them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that how you operate, or
partly? But I think this whole surveys, understanding how people are feeling, all of this, sometimes the right anecdotes don't reach you, but then the data actually does catch that. So it allows you to expand your list of hypotheses, the why, you know, only the why. So it just widens your net to hunt for more areas of improvement.
But this thing of having multiple pipes down to junior janta to get the vibe and the pulse of the company, now you have a lot of senior leaders between you and them. Do you worry about breaking ranks, etc., or that's not something that ever crosses your mind?
Actually, that's never crossed my mind. I've gotten this feedback from 1-2 folks who've joined from larger organizations. Some weren't even fans of it, but I couldn't care. This is exactly the company that I wanted to build. Even if I were to be working in a junior level in Swiggy, being able to cross ranks is a very energizing thing. Shouldn't abuse it. You shouldn't do too much of it. But the line being open is a very important one. I don't know. It seems too dogmatic to break ranks. If I see my leaders too obsessed on breaking ranks, then I'm going to have a tough conversation. What's the problem?
No, I asked precisely because of that. Because again, in these other big firms, which have gotten big over 50 years, over the last 50 years, breaking ranks is a very, very taboo thing, especially in human resource heavy, sales driven orgs, like the hierarchy runs like military, right? And breaking ranks is a thing.
Right.
So it's interesting to know how a founder keeps his or her connect with the org, and there is no other way. You'll always get the soup of the soup of the soup of the soup.
You're going to always get this warm and fuzzy view. And you start drinking too much of the Kool-Aid.
Which brings me to the final thing I want to talk in depth about. How do you as a founder change when you go from small to big, 50 to 5,000, 100 million to 5 billion? How do you as a founder change?
I think the skill or the capability that grows the most on your founding journey is empathy. I was not a big part of teams, or I was a very all about myself kind of person. Even if I would travel alone because I didn't want to be in a group where I had to like get everyone along, and I just wanted to do my thing. So for me, originally the realization dawned in 2016 that side of me has a serious conflict with this side of me running a company, fulfilling my dreams. It was almost like a forcing function. Unless I understand what makes people tick, what their emotions are, what their challenges are, you really can't go and hit your own ambition for impact in life. So it was just a big aha moment for me. And since then, I've just grown to be a bigger and bigger student of this subject. Empathy in terms of understanding teams, motivations is the biggest one. And that was helpful for me as I managed managers, as I managed leaders, as I managed CXOs, etc. And that's one bit, I guess. The second thing is, as a founder, as you scale, you're going to have a lot of these challenges which you'll unfortunately have to solve on your own for your company every time is, you know, org design and org structure and ways of working and all of that. Those two, I guess, are the really, really big learnings. Otherwise, the business is not like suddenly very different from the business it was 3 months anymore. It is going to be a more gradual process. But I guess those are the most important things.
But, you know, you said when you were in the initial phases, you were a lone traveler, you didn't like big groups, not, you know, hang around with people, etc.
No. I liked hanging around with people, but I just wanted to just have my way.
Have your own
thing. Yeah, I have my own thing. Like, I want to do this, so yeah. I want to do this. It's just not the same anymore.
I find that, like, and I assume that that, at that point of time, was a intrinsic part of who you are. Like that's who you were as a person, right? And
correct.
And these intrinsic ways of being are the toughest ones to override with your logical brain, right? Your logical brain realizes that there is a lacuna that I need to fill.
Correct.
So how does one traverse?
Very easy. It's very easy. Your company is not going to be around if you don't fix it. So that way, it was a very forcing function thing for me. If I was probably in a job where the stakes were lesser, then I probably would have figured out ways to not grow it. I couldn't humanly see how I could still be building this company, fulfilling my dream if I didn't do that. So it's just life-threatening ailment that I had to somehow get rid of.
And on the org design subject, is there some course material there? Is there something that you look for inspiration for that piece?
Yeah, I mean, that the inspiration there is mostly other companies known for their practices, their history, their success, consistently being excellent on operating setup. So that is one big part. And the second one is just our own scar tissue. We've made so many mistakes that, you know, each time we make, we don't let that go waste. So those two angles.
How do you record it? How do you code it?
Record the mistake?
How do you record the scar tissue so that it becomes part of the org's memory, not just your memory?
So I guess that's why, right? We collected so much scar tissue in the last 1.5 years. Things came to a head. We have a refreshed values, this thing. But it shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be spiky step function moves. So yeah. That's why I said over-communicating whenever you see parts of this frame is important. We've talked ad nauseum about specific mistakes and have codified in smaller ways. But some of these are, I think, just the ways, right? So we do have a lot of practices. Originally, we felt like our recruitment process was very broken, where anybody would come into the panel. In fact, in the beginning, it would be just one hiring manager and 2-3 friends, and he would just call them, "Arey, kaisa laga, maza hai na? Conversation mein le raha hun." And the other person would say, "Chalo, theek hai, zarurat hai, to le le." But now changes, because then you have to figure out how to scale the machine. And then we introduced a process where people who don't have a vested interest at all in the hiring are going to come and talk about, do I think this individual fits into Swiggy? Does she display the values that we want, etc.? And then you create some more process to make sure that that whole thing scales. So those are the codification things. So for example, if a leader were to come in today and not be diligent enough in an interview debrief, then they'd be called out automatically saying, "Ye kya hai? This doesn't even explain the why. Why did you like this person's curiosity? I couldn't read your one pager and understand why you felt that. So explain to me." So, you know, those are, I think, written form documentation for important processes is a very important course correction mechanism.
And the debriefing piece is a process that you guys set after you realize the problem.
Yeah. After we said that, okay, this part is frame. What have other good companies done? Again, like a lot of problems, we go to Amazon and ask, what have they done? Because they've really invented the machine that builds the machine.
Yeah.
A lot of companies in the world have invented many machines, but on inventing the second machine, very few companies have.
Got it. Okay, I want to end by asking you, as you scale, when do you turn your gaze from growth to profits?
Yeah, there are various parts of our journey where we've had our gaze only on one thing. In 2017 to 2018, we were turning our gaze on both. Then we just turned our gaze only on growth. Then we turned our gaze only on costs. Now we're back to turning our gaze on both. So even as a startup, that's nothing to do with a small company or a large company. As long as you're in a small company mode, you will have to find yourself in all of these three phases. Right now, as the company gets larger, then you start being in this turn your gaze on both a lot more. So if I would say that the first 4 years we were in turn your gaze on both was 25% of the time, right now it's going to be like a lot more percentage. Again, it's as our business expands, right? It's also not the same. Like, we'll have a growth plus P&L focus on food delivery and the growth only focus on Instamart and even more growth only on the seeds. So it's not a very easy classification.
I get you. What I'm thinking is, you know, in the stage that we are in the seed series A sort of stage, you're still trying to get to escape velocity so that you don't come crashing down to Mother Earth, right? Now, once you escape gravity, at least on your initial bet, forget about the other bets that come in the future, you get to have that choice of whether I still want to keep the boosters on at any cost or do I want to start optimizing for efficiency because I don't need that much thrust right now. I was checking for that. Like, is there a conscious time when one...
There is. Right now, it is all very clear. Due to circumstances, because there was a super competitive phase and then there was COVID and all the crazy that happened to the business, we were in complete opposite poles for 2019 and 2020. 2021 for us is actually the balanced view of life.
Got it.
2021 onwards, rather. I hope.
Awesome. On that hopeful note, thank you so much for making the time. I am always amazed by your level of insight and introspection and the speed at which Swiggy continues to grow. So more power to you and your team. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Shashank. Cheers.
Thank you. If you like this episode, don't forget to hit like and subscribe to our channel so we can continue making more of these. And tell us who you'd like us to host next in the comments below. Ciao for now.